I'd like to call the Transportation Finance Committee to order. Break. Today we have a number of bills. Basically, we should be concerned with the financial aspect, the fiscal notes of the bills. Generally, we don't expect many or any amendments, but if there is necessary amendments, we take them because we can, because we're the policy and finance division. But and all the bills that we have on the agenda, you want to take a look at the fiscal note, how it affects, and I'll have the department respond if it any particular effect. And I do believe we have a quorum, do we? I think so. Magnus moves the minutes of March 11th. Any corrections or additions? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary? No. The minutes are approved. The first bill up is House File 3462, Representative Rosenthal. And there is a fiscal note in your packet on that. See. Unless you have someone to move the bill, the chair to move the bill, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3462 authorizes the Department of Public Safety to cancel the driver's license. Once they've been revoked, you apply for reinstatement, and you can do it in two parts or in one part. And if you do it in two parts...
Do you have the mic?
Sorry. If you do it in two parts and they don't pay the second part of the fee, in current law... the driver's license just expires. What this bill attempts to do is make sure that they can't get a driver's license from another state by canceling the license instead of just letting it expire. And with that, I have Ms. McCormick.
Representative Rosenthal, I see there's only two small new language to the bill, so if they look at that. Do you have someone to testify?
Yes, I do.
And Ms. McCormick, we're only discussing the fiscal portion of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. And what this fiscal note does is it talks about the fact that when this partial pay reinstatement program was first implemented, we anticipated a 20% dropout, which would be the people that wouldn't make the second payment, because what this allows you to do is pay the $680 reinstatement fee in two payments. One, when you're ready to reinstate and have met all the requirements to be reinstated, and then the second one in 2 years. And this is based on if you're certified by the Public Defender's Office to be indigent. And so what this bill does, it allows us, if the driver does not pay the second installment, it allows us to cancel that license in hopes that they will pay the second half of the reinstatement fee in order to have a valid driver's license. And so basically this just lays out what we are anticipating the funding could be. As you know, that while DVS collects the reinstatement fee, as shown on the fiscal note, is distributed among the general fund, our special revenue account, the BCA, for lab work and vehicle forfeiture fund. And also there's a fee that goes to the brain trauma fund, and all those fees are wrapped up into what we collect as a reinstatement fee. So this just outlines the fact that we had anticipated a 20% dropout rate, and so we're calculating the fact that there could be 1,650 people that may not reinstate make the second payment in order to receive their valid driver's license. So it's just outlining the process so you understood what the revenues were that were involved in this reinstatement program.
Any questions? Representative Beard.
Let me continue to formulate mine while you call on maybe Representative Mason.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mine was just a real simple question when I'm looking at this $430 surcharge, which to me is a huge amount. And because I know a lot of young people that end up trying to pave it, that lose their licenses, these are huge fees. And I heard something about a lab fee, but...
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mason, the fee, as I said, is divided among the various people that are involved in this process. So you have the forfeiture fund in terms of the vehicle forfeitures that may occur if it's more than not a first-time DWI, but if it's a second or third-time DWI, there may be forfeitures involved, and so you have to have staffing in order for that. The lab for the at the BCA that does the testing associated with the blood alcohol content for the implied consent in order to be able to prove whether the person had violated our DWI laws, and so that's to pay for the lab scientists and the people that were technicians that work on that. It's also to pay for our staff that work to do the administrative reviews with the various DWI offenders. And as I mentioned, the brain trauma fund that the legislature approved funding for. I think it's $50, and it's split up into two $25 payments in this installment plan.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Morrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rosenthal, I may have missed this, so if you could just let me know. I'm looking at the language at 3.28 to 3.31. But my question basically is, it says if the person fails to pay the final installment, I don't know enough of the procedure, Representative, to know how much time do you have before this. If I fail to pay on this day, am I canceled the next day? Mm-hmm. Is there any subsequent notice? Hey, you forgot your payment. I'm not sure how the process works here.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Chair. Representative Morrow, I don't know the answer to that question, but I bet Ms. McCormick does.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Morrow, the department must give due process, and we send out a cancellation notice letting them know that their license will be canceled. And as part of this program, we do send out a notice for the that the second installment of their reinstatement fee must be paid. And then at that time, we give them a date and tell them if it isn't paid by then, if this law passes, then we would be able to say their license would be canceled. And so the hope would be just by saying that, yes, that would get them to make that final payment.
Is there any further questions? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, first of all, let's assume for a moment that this does become law and we're canceling somebody's license. What then happens if they want to get their license back? Do we have additional fees for reinstating a canceled license on top of the second payment that's due?
Ms.
Follow me?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, you would pay what the fee would be to get reinstated. I think if we cancel your license, then that wouldn't be any additional fee. You would just pay the rest of the fee that you needed to pay.
Representative Beard. Thank you. In other words, whatever the second half of that payment was. And you'd indicated that $640 is usually the normal fee for a DWI for reinstatement, is in my understanding. So,
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, at $680.
$340 a whack. Mm-hmm. And then tell me who qualifies for the two-part payment and how far apart those payments are again. I thought I heard you say that a moment ago.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, the person must qualify for being indigent, and what we use as the standard is there's a form that the public defender's office has, and so they must fill out that form, and it has to be certified by the public defender's office, which goes before a judge to approve. And they don't necessarily have to go in front of the judge, but then there's a letter that we receive that says that they've been approved to participate in this program. At the current time, we have 74 people in the program, and 53 of them have made their first payment. So,
Mr. Chair, this maybe isn't directly related to a question for the witness, just a general comment about our policy here. Ms. McCormick and I, a couple years ago, actually intervened for someone who'd gotten a DWI 25 years ago and in another state. The new TSA requirements for Homeland Security kind of matched things up and discovered that her license had actually been revoked because she never paid an $80 fee. And when presented with the $680 bill, this was a substantial chunk of money for a lady who lives in another state in a trailer park and who was trying to rub two nickels together. And it was an amazing thing. I guess it leads me to wonder about the efficacy of the size of the fines we're levying on people who can least afford to pay them. Heck, it would make me pretty darn mad if I had to pay one like that just for reinstatement. But if I remember right, I think maybe our party was in the majority when we cranked these up a few years ago, so I had to be careful about levying or laying guilt. But at some point, if we'd like to start discussing what we're doing to people in financial hardship, in an area of financial hardship, it seems to be, to me, to be piling on somebody who's in a dire strait. I'd certainly welcome that discussion. So whether or not to vote for this motion or not, I'm not sure. But maybe my last question to Ms. McCormick is, when I'm looking at your financials, just to be completely clear, if we pass this bill and there are people who lose their license, you're saying that the state actually saves money to the tune of $520,000 a year? Is that the way I'm reading it?
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, yes, in the sense that it's money that we didn't think we'd be collecting that we think we would be able to collect as a result of people being able to make it in a two-installment payment versus not being able to afford it at all.
Okay. Representative Beard, I think a good legislator would have helped that lady out by helping pay for that.
We did.
Representative Mason? Or Welty? Representative Welty? Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair, either one of you, but that's why I was trying to get a breakdown on these fees. I don't know a lot of people that can afford fees like this. That was the question, is how much extra was available? Is any of this profit? Are you saying all of this, the 250 plus the 430, is you can account for the staff charges?
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mason, I can only really speak on behalf of the Department of Public Safety, and I would say, from knowing the other two divisions, the BCA and State Patrol, which we have to work closely with all three, you know, both the other divisions in Department of Public Safety, that yes, there are specific costs and specific staffing that are tied to the revenues that we get from this fee.
Mr. Chair.
Did you have
Mr.
further
representation?
No, that's
fine. Ms. McCormick, too, and for the members, we don't establish the fee. That's in another committee, so we can't be working over the fees too much.
All right. Mr. Chair? May I?
Oh, Representative Newton, I think.
Representative
Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mason and Beard. I happen to agree with you that the fees are kind of extreme, and we all know that fees have been going up and up and up the past number of years, and I think it's something we should look at, but this looks to really give someone back their driver's license, and there's nothing I can do about the fees right now, but I think you're right.
Representative Welty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Rosenthal and to the Commissioner, I'm wondering, the reinstatement, can you give me a list of all of the possible situations in which someone may need to have their license reinstated? So I'm wondering how many people we're talking about affecting with this bill and the cancellation because you failed to pay it. Is it just for DWI cases or are there others? And I was looking through the bill trying to get clarification, so if you could please provide that, I'd appreciate that.
Ms. McCormick is directly, we hope we're sticking to the fiscal part. This is maybe policy, Representative Welty, but Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Representative Welty, the only people that can, they have to be people that have lost their license because of a DWI violation, and so they're getting reinstated. But the only people that can pay on an installment plan such as this are people that are determined to be indigent, and the statute specifically states that you're determined to be indigent if you comply with the public defender's office guidelines for indigency. And as I stated, right now we have 74 people that are in the program, and we do give out information to people about the program, and we have 53 that have made their first payment.
Representative Welty.
Okay, thank you. And I appreciate that clarification that we're really talking about the DWI offenders. And I'm just wondering now, you know, members, if we think about this, person is going to have to pay, so we're going to have to pay $680 to have the license reinstated. And then on top of that, if the legislation passes that we're talking about to go to a breathalyzer or the, the ignition interlock.
Yeah.
We're going to assess that onto the individual as well. I mean, I know that those dollar amounts really add up quickly, and I'm just really wondering if this is going to be a lot for a person to afford in a short period of time. Thank you.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rosenthal, Ms. McCormick, The nature of these questions is confusing me because I thought I understood what this bill was doing, and now I feel like I don't. As I understand it, this bill is not raising any fees. Currently in law, there is a provision by which people who are not of very high means can make installment payments on a penalty for a violation to get their license reinstated. And that's designed to help them. The problem is, or at least the problem I see this trying to address, is that some people then are not making that second installment.
Right.
So they're getting their license back with the first installment, but then not fulfilling their commitment because there's no mechanism in law to provide a penalty. They can just let their license expire and move on. This would put some mechanism in law that would make it more likely for them to pay the full total that the penalty has been established for them. Is that correct,
Mr. Chair? Representative Morgan, yes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Morgan, for explaining that too. Any Representative Holmberg, do you have a question? If not, are any further questions? Not, Chair will renew the motion that House File 3462 be passed and laid on a laid for inclusion in the omnibus transfer. You don't have to vote, no. In the omnibus bill, is that satisfactory with you, or do you want it?
Sure.
You didn't want it to go on its own. Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Holberg, would you want to come up and we'll move you ahead because I think some of the people have to go? And that's House File 3490.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I do have an A1 amendment that I think needs to be passed out, but in the interest of time, I think Mr. Estenson from the Chamber of Commerce will go over briefly the bill. I'll follow up with a little additional information by then. Hopefully, you all have the amendment.
I'm sorry, did you move the bill? I didn't.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to move House File 3490 for consideration for the committee.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Estenson?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Jeremy Estenson. I work for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and we're here in support of House File 3490. And the bill, well, first I'll tell you a little bit about what it does, and then I'll tell you why it came about. It's two parts, really. One is in Section 3, Subdivision 2, and that would ask a proponent for a particular fixed guideway corridor, in other words, a rail corridor, to bring to the legislature a financial plan that talks about both capital and operating costs. And the second part is a requirement that the Met Council, once the amendment is adopted, every 2 years during the bonding year, bring a document to Representative Leader, Senator Murphy, and a variety of other folks, talking about the overall system health in terms of what Met Council sees based on its long-term planning document, existing revenue sources, potential costs according to the different corridors that they're planning on. And one thing that the Met Council wanted me to point out is that this is in no way something that is designed to be limiting. In fact, just the opposite. We're hoping that when folks come forward with these plans, these financial plans, it's more about creativity and flexibility and looking at potentially new and better ways of doing things and potentially maybe even different types of revenue streams. And, Mr. Chair, the reason the bill is in front of you is that the shortfall, this biennium, the general fund shortfall, which found its way into Met Council's operating budget this year, was pretty substantial. And the business community and probably many of you aren't convinced that we're necessarily out of the woods yet, not to mention the fact that something like this could happen again in the future. And I guess we sort of base it on not only what we know, but what we don't know. What we know is that this recession came about quickly. It was probably more severe than economists have predicted, and recovery is slow. We know that Met Council is set to take on an additional $44 million of operating costs between 2013 and 2014. $7 million of those costs are going to be general fund dollars because of Central Corridor. And finally, one of the things that many of us deal with all the time is that, politically speaking, transportation projects generally lose out in budget battles when health care and education and things like that are involved. But, Mr. Chair, it's the unknowns, I think, that have us more concerned. The February forecast indicated that MVS revenue is probably going to creep up some. And in fact, it might creep up enough to cover short-term, next biennium's operating costs for Metropolitan Transit. However, that same forecast also showed that many of the other states' revenue sources are going to continue to languish. And based on how MVES has performed over the last 5 or 6 years, it gives us some pause. It gives us some reason to take a second and wonder whether or not that might be true. And so, while we build out our fixed guideway system, I think the reason that we want to know both what the operating costs might be and what some potential options might be, and to keep that discussion in front of all of you as decision makers and us as stakeholders, is because we don't want to see a reduction in bus service as determined by the Met Council. And we're also concerned about things like shifts in the motor vehicle sales tax statutory allocations, 60, 36, and four, and I know a number of other groups share our concern. Now, Mr. Chair, having said that, over the next 20 years, it's kind of an exciting time. We're looking at building a rail infrastructure system that, in the spirit of the 2008 bill, the business community supports. But what happened this biennium is giving us some concerns, and we just want to be prepared and be planning. And that's what this bill is about. It's an attempt to keep that conversation in step with the discussion to track down capital costs, which frankly are probably easier than it's in good times, I guess, operating costs in the state's commitment have generally not been a problem. But it's these downturns that have really given us concern. And our goals are to lessen the impact of any future economic downturn on the system, to preserve service where it's most necessary, and by talking about and keeping the conversation in front of you folks, maybe make the state's general fund commitments to transit a higher priority, and potentially will improve the planning process by keeping everybody a bit more informed.
Representative Holmberg, do you want to move the amendment before we get discussion?
Sure. Mr. Chair, and the amendment was to address concerns with the Met Council. And instead of doing this every year, it would be done every other year in the bonding year. And so this amendment came at the request of the Met Council.
Actually, I'll just, to bring the amendment before us, it's House, or it's Amendment A1. So that's the discussion you want on amendments, so we can discuss the whole bill right now?
Yeah, the A1 would put the bill in the shape that I'd like to discuss it.
It's in the docket now. We can adopt the amendment now, yeah. Any discussion on the amendment before we get into the bill? Okay. We Representative Hornstein or Hausman?
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Oh, I don't care. I mean, I have a question.
I take a vote, but Representative Hausman was first.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why just this form of transportation? Why just the fixed guideways? Why not roads and bridges, where we also have a huge shortfall? We can quantify it. MnDOT has quantified it. We subsidize that system. Why not require all of this, a financial plan, et cetera, I guess I would be interested in the chamber's response. This sounds like is it a chamber initiative?
Mr. Estenson or Representative Holberg?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, I've been talking about this issue for a number of years, and in talking with Mr. Estenson, we kind of worked together. I'm not aware of if it was a formal chamber bill or not. I don't know that he could speak to that. But your issue about why don't we do this for roads, well, we do it for roads in the form of a STIP, and that they show the projection of the revenues coming in, how much is going to be used for operating, you know, MnDOT, how much, I mean, they break out the money, what's going to be used for construction, maintenance, et cetera. So we do that for planning purposes with roads.
And, Mr. Chair, my understanding from Mr. Essenson's testimony was the reason you're bringing this forward is because of this economic time and this shortfall alarms you, but aren't those same shortfalls affecting what we have available for roads and bridges, the backlog?
Mr. Estenson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, I suspect that it is, and I think maybe to address both of these questions, if you'll remember the 2008 bill, we also asked for MnDOT to look at doing things better and shedding more light on their processes, and I'm delighted to tell you that we're supporting Senator Dibble's Senate File 1060, and I apologize for not knowing who's got the companion over here, but it's Representative Hortman, asking that department to report on progress, and in fact, the commissioner, based on the Strategic Management Task Force recommendations, is starting to take steps. And so these two aren't maybe identical tools, but they're in the same vein.
And then, Mr. Chair, I think here's what I would need to understand in terms of the chamber's point of view. I will tell you that reading this, it sort of feels like somebody who has a huge concern that people are going to ask for guideway projects more frequently. And there would be several ways to respond to that at a time of shortfall and with insufficient revenue. A bill like this, or the chamber sitting down with all of the other groups, Transportation Alliance and Transit for Livable Communities and all of the other groups, to say, what are we going to do about it? What is our long-range plan? Where should we go with revenue for capital and revenue for operating, and sit around the table until there's a solution? I mean, I think there would be several ways, if I were chamber and cared about the economic health of the region and believed in this tool as an essential component of our being economically competitive with other regions around the country, that I'd want to sit down around a table and help people figure out where will the revenue come from for capital, where will the revenue come from for operating. And I just wonder why the chamber would choose this route.
Well, Mr. Chair and
Representative
Hausman, this would inform that process. If you don't have the report where all the information is one place where you can look out a number of years, then you end up having to cobble it all together and you're not sure. I mean, I think this is a good planning document to begin to have that discussion. mean, if you, right now, we don't have all of this in one spot where it's all laid out, and we can say, okay, under current funding levels based on the February forecast and the capital expenditures and the building schedule of the various lines and expansions, we're good to go for capital and operating of this system until 2015. And then we need to look at more revenue, et cetera. We don't have that document anywhere right now.
And Mr. Chair, just one final, I guess, question then. Don't we, though, have the planning agencies in place? I mean, isn't Met Council charged with a 20-year plan and bringing those forward through the governor's budget for funding?
Representative Hober?
And Mr. Chair and Chair Hausman, and they do, and they do their transportation update every 4 years, and so that's why I don't think this is a huge issue for them. My understanding from Ms. Soares is that there's been a meltdown of the fiscal note process, but that preliminarily they're looking at about $50,000 for this, and that the greater mm-hmm. Minnesota Transit portion of it at about $2,000. But that's another reason why this gets laid on the table, so we can have time for the fiscal note to catch up and get massaged, if you will, moving forward.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And, you know, as usual, Representative Hausman did ask pretty much my question. But, you know, and I think there's two parts to the question, too, that maybe need to be amplified a little more. So one is, you know, I share the concern about it's not an even playing field necessarily between roads and transit. And part of it, you know, when you look at line 6 on page 3, that is the crux of the issue, Representative Holberg, and we've talked about it. You know, what are the estimated annual operations and maintenance expenditures going to be? Mm-hmm. And we don't have 0.6. Nearly as many dedicated funds for transit as we have for roads. And so it's almost a chicken and egg issue because, you know, what I think we need from the chamber is the same kind of support we had for the quarter-cent sales tax, and thank you. I mean, I think that was hugely important to move that the transportation discussion along. But it is to sort of figure out, well, where are we going to increase the dedicated sources of funding so that we can really have operations and maintenance expenditures that are going to meet the need. But I think what we're all on the same page in is there is a tremendous need. How are we going to meet it? And I think we need to sort of look at the fact that we didn't get everywhere we need to go, Mr. Chair, with our override. We started that process. But I hope we could consider you know, maybe ramping that up 0.25 to a 0.5 because, you know, over time, because that's what we really need in order to get to where we need to go. And then the second part of Representative Hausman's question, I really think that this ought to be a collaborative process, that, you know, you have the Transportation Alliance, you have the transit groups. And again, I don't think there's a lot of difference, and I don't think there's huge disagreement about the need to plan. But it would be really good to have those voices at the table to craft something like this, because you know, there's no question that we need to plan better and to be able to identify sources of money before we build. I think that's kind of the thrust here, but I just think it's, you know, we need to kind of make sure that we're also looking at where we're going to get the funding from and making sure we have more stakeholders at the table. And so I don't know if you have some thoughts on that, Representative Holberg.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, Holberg. Representative Hornstein, well, then maybe I need to go back, because I think knowing where you're at any given time is good. And so is it your problem with this with proposed sources? I mean, I viewed this as under current law, current revenue projections, and current things that are funded and on the book and ready for expansion, how does that fit with our current funding sources? And that's how I looked at this, as a snapshot of where we are now and where are we trying to go, and if there is a gap, you know, where might we fill that gap?
Yeah, I mean, for planning purposes, that's helpful, I think. But I want to make sure that, you know, along with this, that we we bring some ideas to the table about making sure we get to those gaps. Just to sort of have this out there in a void is problematic, and I think we ought to have a few more voices helping to craft the actual planning document, which this would be. It's a little different than the STIP because it's not, you know, it's not exactly the same. So, you know, I'm not hostile. I just want to make sure that we, you know, we do this in the right kind of way.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm glad he's not hostile.
I mean, I you know, I think that Representative Hausman's right that I think this, you know, it assumes that there's parity. And we still have an uneven playing field.
Mr. Chair, when you say it assumes that there's parity, I don't understand what you're saying when you say that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you said we want to have the same kind of system we have in place with the STIP with roads. I think it's an apples and oranges type of conversation.
Thank you, Representative Horton. We have a bunch of questions. Representative Horton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if we could adopt the amendment to get the bill in the shape she would like, because I have a very tiny amendment to offer. But I don't think it would be in order while hers is on the table.
Is it a technical amendment, you mean?
Yes. Mine is.
You just want to state it, and we'll have Mr. Burris listen.
Yep. On line 3.9. Maybe Representative Holberg will even incorporate it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we do have the A1 still before us. I don't think her amendment's to the A1. I think it's to the bill itself.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same. I'm sorry, I was interrupted. I didn't know what you were proposing.
I have an additional amendment, and maybe she could incorporate it into her amendment, and then we could vote on the A1, or...
Do you want to state? Did you state the amendment so Mr. Bruce could hear?
On line 3.9, after the word report, add the word electronically and delete the words chairs and ranking minority.
Are you in amendment A1?
On the bill.
2.9?
3.9.
Representative Holberg, did you hear the
we just expanded.
Proposed amendment?
I did, and I'd be happy to incorporate that unless somebody from Met Council or MnDOT would object.
Mr. Burris, you you want to restate the amendment when you get a chance?
Mr. Chair and members, I've got page 3, line 9. After report, insert electronically and delete chairs and ranking minority.
Is that your amendment, Representative Hortman? We can incorporate that into the A1 amendment, Representative Holberg.
Works for me. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. If no discussion or question, we'll adopt the A1 amendment. Any questions? If not, all in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
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 Contrary? The amendment is adopted as amended. Now, let's see. What we got next? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of reluctant to bring this up, but when Representative Hausman threw down the challenge, I can hardly help myself with her assertion that we subsidize roads and bridges. That gets thrown around a lot, and it relates to something that I heard Representative Hornstein say, that we're comparing apples and oranges, and you're exactly right. We are. When we're dealing with fixed guideways or with transit subsidies, they're not paid for largely by user fees, with the possible exception of fare box recovery, maybe to the extent of 30% or so. Way less than that, I'm understanding, on the light rail and on North Star. These are things we need to know. My assertion is, when it comes to roads and bridges, the vehicles and the people who use them largely pay for them, with the exception of city streets, which are usually paid for in local property tax base, but city streets usually define local property, and that's a decision we've made over the last 100 years. But the assertion that we're continually subsidizing automobile traffic on roads and bridges is one that I want to challenge and challenge strongly. And if we're going to continue to talk about it, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to request that we have a discussion time here in this committee, probably after deadlines, to actually quantify and bring the proof that we're actually subsidizing automobile roads and bridges, which are paid for with user fees, members. Transit, by the way, gets a large share of its money from automobiles, from the sales tax we pay on cars and trucks. We divert that from roads and bridges into transit. It's a policy decision we've made, but I would contend that that hardly qualifies as subsidizing motor vehicle traffic when we divert user fees from motor vehicles into transit projects. And again, I'm not saying that that's the wrong thing to do. I'm just objecting strenuously the continued assertion that we subsidize roads and bridges at the expense of who knows what, because that sentence is really never finished. And with that, that's the end of my comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Annette will take care of that, the discussion.
Thank you.
Representative Magnus.
Chairman, I'd love to jump in here, but I think we'll save it for another day. I'm shocked to hear our transit advocates tell us now today that they need more money when we debated the Chapter 152 bill, and I asked them on the floor, and I asked them here, where are you going to get the money? Oh, plenty of money. So, Mr. Chairman, I won't jump into it at this time. I think we should study it before we do the
I think that's train. A good subject, yeah. Thank you. Representative Hausman. Hausman?
Well, I was just going to take on all those issues, but I think you probably don't want us to.
No, I think we kind of get diverted from our bill, perhaps. Representative Morrill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to come back to the bill then a little bit. Representative Holbrook, in principle, I think I'm with you on this. What I'm wondering, though, and I don't think you can answer, I think I'm directing it to the folks behind you, is that we have a number of reports and the like that we're asking of MnDOT and Met Council on a number of separate issues, whether it's state rail plan, state transit plan, guideways. And so I have two comments to share. One, I'm okay with the general concept, but I think we do need to have these kind of reports, if you will, that look out into the future. And I think they also, so one, I think we should have it so we can do this easily and not piecemeal, not have this report separated from this report, because I think it's very hard to follow in a holistic way. But my second comment is this, and in fact, I had constituents asking me this today about what happens when you build a new bridge, Terry? Does the state build in the cost of maintaining this bridge over time? I honestly don't know, A, the answer to that, and B, if there is an answer, where to find it. So again, I think I'm directing it to you, but also to the folks sitting behind you. I do think there's a long-term maintenance and operation cost to roads and bridges that we also should be trying to account for, especially after the legislative auditor's report about preservation and maintenance.
Representative Holbrook.
And Mr. Chair, I don't think the STIP is perfect in identifying particular costs for a particular bridge, et cetera, but it does system-wide inform us as to what percentage of the funds are going to construction, what percentage of the funds are going to maintenance, which percentage of the funds are going to the state patrol, et cetera. So we see that, and it gets updated in long-range terms and in short-range terms, of course, always being flexible because of how the money comes from the feds or doesn't come from the feds, et cetera. But I think that recently what we've seen out of Metro Transit and Met Council is that when funds have been short, the system that takes the brunt of it is the bus system. They reduce routes, they increase fares, etc. And if we don't have a larger picture of this whole system and what we need in order to fund what we've committed to, how can we move or plan? New funding around here doesn't come overnight. It takes a while to get everybody convinced of the need, et cetera. And so if you don't have some kind of plan where it's all together and you can use the forecast and, you know, in this case they'd be using a November forecast every other year to inform the legislature by January on best guesses, are we able to fund what we have and plan for funding what we're proposing? And I don't think that's so outrageous.
Representative Morrill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to follow up. I think the testimony from Met Council was they didn't raise fares, at least recently, and they didn't cut routes on buses recently. And I just raised that concern because I'm going to keep banging the table on Greater Minnesota Transit and what happened to Greater Minnesota Transit even within the last week. So I just want to be clear, at least according to Met Council, they haven't been having to raise fares and haven't been having to
And
cut
Mr.
routes.
Chair, Representative Morrill, that's correct within the last 18 months to 2 years.
That's
prior to that, there was a major reorganization. Then we saw gas prices spike. We saw ridership shoot up. That kind of got them through a little bit for a while. We've now seen MVEST projections go up a little bit, which they're just eking by. We've seen a reduction in their general fund again in a balancing budget balancing move. And how many of us at the table here or in the room know what the ramifications of that general fund reduction are on the system as a whole? Do we know that? Do we know what it does to their planning? Do we have a report that tells us in 2010 it cost this much and this is how we're using it to fund all of these systems? I don't think we do.
Unless there is further discussion, I'd like to have Ms. Sewers. We don't have a fiscal note in your packet, and Representative Hobart alluded to that. Ms. Sewers, you just want to comment?
Mr. Chair and members, with the amendment, I think the fiscal note would have changed anyway because the fiscal or the amendment changes the report, the legislative report, and delays it out until January of 2012. So with that change, there are three agencies that were on the note. One was MnDOT, the other Met Council, and then the third was Minnesota Management and Budget. And I'm not anticipating any costs from MMB. I think with the amendment, the costs will be in fiscal year 2012, and they would be $50,000 from the Met Council, and this could be their general fund or MVEST funds. And then the other cost would be from MnDOT, which would be $3,000, and that would be a general fund cost.
And, Mr. Chair, I'd like the opportunity in the next 9 days to work on those fiscal notes with the agencies. As if it is true that they collect and prepare almost all this information anyway, I think there may be an opportunity to take another look at those numbers.
And Ms. Zurl, I presume you can speak with Ms. Holbert. Any further discussion on the bill? If not, Representative Holbert will lay the bill over for potential input.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
The Representative Junkie.
He does have a fiscal note.
He does. House File 3334. The chair will move it so it gets before the committee. And we do have a fiscal note in here.
And Mr. Chair, let me explain that briefly. That fiscal note will probably be no good because we're redoing language. And the language is based on the original bill. I won't go into the fiscal note heavily other than to say I think there were a bunch of pieces missing in it, too, because they only calculated MnDOT's costs of preparing bids. They did not project out the possible savings within our districts on trunk highway construction, which would come back into that same thing. But regardless of that, Mr. Chair, I had MnDOT and the industry folks in my office this morning, I think they all agreed to forge ahead with some different language on this. But for your information, I just want to get the concept before this committee. And then as you put out a bill or as Representative Hornstein moves his bill out to the House floor, we're going to look at making sure it's in one or both of those bills. But we're still developing the language, and I want to get the issue before you, which I can talk about briefly. And so, members, what this bill does or will do or continues to do is bring the alternative bid process to the forefront. And again, for those of you that don't know what that is, just a refresher, alternative bidding is where the concrete, we make roads out of two major materials, concrete and asphalt. And unfortunately, I think there's been too much pavement selection that's done in MnDOT. And then once the pavement selection is done, it's moved out into the bid process without this alternative bid. And here's the reason I think we need to focus on this. And again, to MnDOT's credit, they have indicated, I've talked to the commissioner's office and others, that they are moving that way. And in the next couple of years, they expect that all of this will hopefully be coming out in alternative bid process. But we want and would feel a lot more comfortable to put some language in to encourage them to continue that process. And that's really what we're working on with them right now. So I'll give them credit. They're working on it. Alternative bid then would mean going forward, if you have, say, a road in Representative Magnus's district, a two-lane state highway, that's ready for rebuild or major reconstruction. What they'd do is go out and they'd ask for bids in both concrete and pavement, asphalt pavement, but equalizing them. We know that concrete costs more up front typically, but lasts longer. Asphalt, we know, is probably less expensive for the most part up front, and then but has to come back with an overlay sometime in that life. But what the alternative bid process does is consider all those factors so that both concrete and asphalt people can bid on an equal basis. And certainly we want to look at that. Here's the reasons why, again, as we talk about jobs this year, members, if we had this in place now for all the projects being let today in rural Minnesota, for example, where I live, where it would be applicable, we'd have probably more bidders. There's only a relatively few bidders in Minnesota on concrete. Okay, there's a couple in the Twin Cities. We see a lot of our jobs being done by South Dakota, Wisconsin companies on the concrete project. So number one, I'd rather see our Minnesota contractors be involved more. Nothing wrong with the other companies, but I'm a little parochial when it comes to those jobs in my district. But number two, we think it'll bring in many more bidders. And the more bidders you bring to a process that can do a job, the likelihood that that bid will come in lower. And indeed, if it comes in lower, that means more money available for more projects in our district and more jobs that can be on the ground in any given year. So that's why we're feeling an urgency, at least with my contractors and folks in my area that I work with, these companies out there. And MnDOT, again, to their credit, I think is moving that way, but we want to give them a friendly pat forward on this and acquiesce that we're with them on it. One of the other things we mentioned, since I know some of you would be curious, and it was interesting, the in the previous committee, they also mentioned that using asphalt is a greener technology than concrete. And let me tell you why, because we don't think about it. Our asphalt people will point out we have little ribbons of oil wells running up and down the state called highways. When they redo asphalt, they're able to capture and reuse about 30% of that product now. So instead of going back out to the oil fields for new product, we're actually recycling and using it. So asphalt has become a very green process in the last few years, and we want an opportunity to bring all these new factors into these bids in an alternative bid process moving forward. So again, what you see in front of you was a first draft, and Mr. Burris put it together and others. It's a good start, but now we're working with Mr. Burris and MnDOT and the industry to kind of caress it a little bit so we're not stepping on any toes, but we do want to be in the door over at MnDOT making sure we're pushing forward with this. So I bring that to you, and Mr. Chair and members, I'll bring language to you, and you can distribute it to your committee as soon as we have it ready, and hopefully for inclusion in your bill moving out of here in the next week or so.
And the fiscal note that we have will be revamped.
Right.
And no, any questions of Representative Junkie? Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Junkie, just in looking at the fiscal note, there's mention of the two-lane projects in areas like yours or mine, and difficulty of doing concrete on some of those projects. Will your amended or new language maybe address that situation as well? Because I think that will lower the fiscal note as well.
Well, it will, and Mr. Chair and Representative Morrow, again, just, and it's, this is all what if and how about and could we. Again, to the fiscal note, we've had two projects that were just bid in my District 8 or near it. Painesville Bypass was one. I can't think of the other one. Had we had the alternative bid process available, my contractors estimate on those two projects alone we'd have saved between $4 and $5 million. So again, when you look at the fiscal note, yeah, it talks about what you have to do, extra steps maybe within their office, but in no way, shape, or form considers the potential savings out there.
Representative Morrow.
That's okay, I'll speak with
any further questions.
But anyway, this note is kaput. Because what the note also assumed is they were going to have to go out and redraft plans and do things because we were going to interrupt them in the middle of projects. But what our intent is going forward, not going backwards or interrupting what's already in works.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Well, to that point, I think there are a number of fiscal notes that are with bills that are before us that aren't necessarily accurate. And what's the process going to be for
when we get
correcting those and updating them?
Representative Hornstein, Mrs. Ewers is working with that. When it comes back, when we put the bill together, we'll have to review those again. Okay. Temporarily.
All right. Thank you.
And for the members of the committee, it's not that easy just to say it's comparable. Concrete and bituminous, a lot of factors involved, which don't come up, and you got to make sure you have apples against apples.
Yep.
And thank you, Representative Junkie. I don't think we need any testimony from your...
No. I have people there if you need, but I just want to get the concept in front of you, and you'll see some amended language come before you, hopefully in your next bigger
bill. So House File 3334 will
thank
be
you,
laid
Mr.
for
Chair,
possible
members.
Inclusion in an omnibus bill. The next bill is Representative Beard 3224. Representative Beard, what's your wish on this bill?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the bill and then lay it over for possible inclusion in your finance bill. But as I understand, we have until the end of March if we need to come back and ask for it to move separately.
That's correct.
If I may do that, or discuss that a little later if we need to.
And I believe there's not a fiscal... The fiscal note is zero.
The fiscal note is zero, yes.
Right.
I got a fiscal note, and it is zero, Mr. Chairman.
Right. Representative Beard, do you want to explain?
Please. Let me just introduce it, and then I'm going to have Brad Larson from MnDOT actually explain the bill. Members, this is an agency bill that basically will codify alternative financing and investment in projects that MnDOT's trying to do. Remember, a couple years ago, we were... talking about at the 11th hour, perhaps having the contracting companies actually help finance the Crosstown Highway project whenever there was some federal monies that didn't come through in a timely fashion. They've done some things creatively over on the Bren Road interchange on 169, and there's other things out there that MnDOT would like to do, but they're asking us to actually put it in statute that gives them the permission to explore these options, enter into agreements, and particularly the agreements for repayment and where the funds would come from and how they are repaid. Mr. Chairman, that is going to be, I think, the extent of my comments. I'd like to introduce Mr. Brad Larson from MnDOT to go into it.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, thank you. My name is Brad Larson. I'm MnDOT's Director of Traditional Innovative Finance here to testify on in support of this bill. To accompany my testimony, I actually have a couple handouts here that...
Mr. Larson, too, if we could keep it confined to the fiscal portion of the bill, because policy supposedly has been taken care of to some degree or not. Thank you. Anyhow.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. These two handouts that are coming around, one of the handouts that's entitled Innovative Transportation Finance is simply... A fact sheet that provides some general and background information on innovative finance and MnDOT's new innovative finance initiative. The second handout coming around, which is entitled Innovative Transportation Finance Bill, actually provides a summary of this bill, that provides the purpose and need type background for the bill. Essentially, what both of these provisions do in this bill is expand the financial toolbox for the department and give MnDOT a couple more options to consider in trying to meet transportation needs out there. The first provision, the alternative financing and investment in transportation projects, would enable the department to consider and take advantage of opportunities where governmental or nonprofit or private entities were willing to finance or invest in a transportation project to accelerate a project or make it more cost effective overall. The second provision that's in this bill would provide the department with the authority to apply for and receive financial assistance through the federal TIFIA program. And TIFIA is essentially the Federal Transportation Infrastructure Bank that provides low-interest loans, lines of credit to both public and private entities for generally up to one-third of eligible project costs on projects. Both of these provisions they are not going to come close to solving all of our transportation needs and issues that we have in the state. But both of them could provide the department with some additional options to get a couple more projects done each year that can't otherwise get done. With that, Mr. Chair, members, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Beard or Mr. Larson. I had the opportunity to attend your workshop on this last fall, and we've had some discussion, I don't recall, in which committees. And I don't have any problem with the second part of your bill, but my question always has been, in the first part, are there any standards about... I mean, basically, you could set up a scenario where communities with great wealth or a big, very successful company or whatever could drive a transportation project, push it ahead of other projects, et cetera. Say if they wanted to pay for enhancements that nobody else could afford, is that good policy? Is it good policy to have certain communities in which their local match could be paid for by large corporations versus other communities that would never have that opportunity because they don't have that type of commercial or industrial tax base? I mean, I don't see any of those issues being addressed in this bill, and so I'm a little reticent to be a big cheerleader for that because I'm afraid that we're going to walk into some problems of the haves versus the have-nots or private entities with money driving transportation policy. In other words, we'll give you $30 million, but we want the bridge to look like this and match our building. Or you can think of all kinds of scenarios, and with no more guidance than this 8 or 10 lines on this piece of paper, it makes me nervous.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, that's a very good question. That's a concern that many other members and many other folks have expressed. As we explore different innovative finance tools, and these are just two of the provisions that give us some authority to use two types of financing tools, we're also looking at various types of revenue generating tools that we don't have any legislation that we're bringing this session to advance. But as we look at all these different innovative finance tools and techniques, we believe that there are going to be opportunities for all transportation modes, all types of projects in all locations around the state, whether they're rural, urban, whether they're developing or developed communities. A number of the ideas that we've looked at around that first provision, the alternative financing and investment in transportation provision, a number of the projects we've looked at to try to use an approach like that, which really made us believe we need this type of authority if we actually have these opportunities that arise and we can take advantage of them in the future. They were in areas, much different areas around the state. There were a couple projects in greater Minnesota. There was one in the metro area that we looked at. There was another project down in southern Minnesota that we looked at in all different types of communities. So I think from the standpoint of rich companies trying to buy their way into line and having their projects jump the queue, one of the things that we are definitely committed to is that in any innovative finance technique that we try to use, explore, and pursue, we are not going to be delaying or displacing other projects to accelerate these projects. We really want this to be about doing more, growing the pie, trying to get more done every year, not trying to delay some projects to do other projects. And so we believe that in anything that we do here, if it's not thoroughly analyzed, vetted with stakeholders, that we can make a strong business case, makes good fiscal sense, and that it has solid political and public support, that in the future you'll come back and limit this authority more for us, take it away from us. So we would just ask to have the ability to earn your trust in doing and attempting some of these things if these opportunities come to us in
the
future.
And, Mr. Chair, it would have been helpful to me had that standard been included in the bill, that you weren't going to displace or, you know, push back other projects. And just two comments. I mean, I know the heartburn and have seen it where we had federal money earmarked for certain projects that weren't even in the 5 or 10 year plan, you know, and how do we accommodate the earmarking for federal projects and not push anybody further down the list, or, you know, local match issues, et cetera. And that's just around federal money and projects. The second thing is, I would, given them what I believe to be the real mess of the UPA project and the tolling and what my constituents are putting up with on 35, I don't know that I'd leave the tolling piece in here either. Those would just be my comments.
Representative Beard, did you want to comment?
Yeah, related to Representative Kohlberg's question, I'm thinking of a couple things where we actually, I think, are doing this now. I'm thinking of the 35W bridge. I think that when that had to be rebuilt in a hurry, I think the city of Minneapolis had a lot of input into design and lighting and so on. I don't know if they picked up the tab on that, but it was an opportunity for a city to participate. Bren Road, a 169 project, I think jumped ahead because United Healthcare got involved. I don't know how you guys feel about it. Personally, I applauded them for doing that. It needed to be done. The Elk Run project, maybe Representative Welty can speak to it, on 52 in Rochester, I think, came about and certainly moved ahead because a wealthy investor is trying to build a bioscience campus there, and it just seemed prudent to most of us to actually have that move ahead. So I think it's happening in some cases already, so I don't think we're breaking entirely new ground here. This just kind of, I think, officially blesses the process and gets us engaged in how it's happening. Good question.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. It's kind of an interesting meeting. So Representative Hausman was making a point I wanted to make before, and now Representative Holberg is making a similar point that I had in terms of a concern here. And I guess when I read this to either of you, you know, when I see line 9, you know, these agreements with private and nonprofit entities, and then you see line 12, you know, it's kind of I read it as code for building these privatized toll roads, which, you know, haven't been very successful in California and Texas. And mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if this language, you know, enables that to happen, because that would be a problem, I think. That you know, privatized toll roads have not been successful, and it's not a direction I'd like to see Minnesota move in. So if you could comment on that.
Either one of you gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, thank you for that question. You are correct in that those two sentences in there, well, the one that talks about toll facilities, that provision actually was when this bill was heard in the Senate Transportation Committee, was actually removed. These references to other statutes, that we will comply with these other statutes, that piece has been viewed as superfluous, essentially, because we have to comply with those statutes if we're doing those types of things anyhow, if it is a toll type facility. This provision right here is not giving us any type of new authority to enter into any type of toll project. That's continues to be governed by our current toll facilities P3 statute that's on the books. And essentially all this is allowing MnDOT to do is enter into different types of financing agreements where might be a private entity, might be a nonprofit, might be some other type of governmental entity that wants to advance us the funding or loan us the funding for a project. and then we'll pay them back over a certain amount of time. It does not involve big types of what you've heard about as public-private partnership projects that involve long-term lease agreements where there's an operations and maintenance component, a design, build, finance, operation, maintenance type, procurement type approach. That is not this provision is not giving us any new authority in those areas that doesn't already, outside of what already exists in the current toll facilities, public-private partnerships.
And Hornstein, do you have a further question?
Well, I mean, again, that's not clear if you read lines 8 and 9. It just says the commissioner may enter into agreements, and then it lists these things, but it doesn't, it's hard to know whether it's new authority or existing authority. It just says may do this, but I mean, I don't want to spend more time on it. It's a discussion we should have because it's not very clear.
Mr. Chairman,
if
it seems good to include this in the omnibus finance bill, perhaps we'll bring back an amendment at that time and address these concerns. Okay. I share Representative Hornstein's concern about that line.
And as Mr. Larson pointed out, I think the big concern on toll roads, they can't do it. We have statute limiting what they can do in a toll road.
Right.
Any further questions, Representative Hornstein?
No, I'm done. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If not, House File 3224 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Next bill up is Representative Morrow. House File 2753. You have an amendment?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Is that basically a delete off?
No. No, it is not.
It's not.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2753, and I believe it needs to move to finance, if I understand correctly.
You wanted to hold it over, you said?
No, I do not want to
hold it over. You want to go separately?
Yes.
Fine.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move the A1 amendment, put the bill in the shape I'd like it in, and then we can talk about both the bill and the amendment.
Representative Morrow moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Not all in favor, say aye. What?
It was up at the back. I apologize.
It's in your packet.
H2753A1. I have one.
Dan, do you need one?
I'm trying to find it.
Dan, do you need one?
Everyone have? Everyone, you have it?
Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I could talk about the bill itself if we need to get additional copies.
She's getting some more around, apparently. You want to discuss the...
Mr. Chair, members, what House File 2753 essentially does is to accelerate some of the Chapter 152 bonding authority that was granted to MnDOT. It moves $100 million from 2017 and $100 million from 2018 and moves them up in the cycle to years 2011 and 2012. We have talked with MnDOT about whether MnDOT could handle the debt service on this. My understanding is that MnDOT can handle this debt service, and the theory being that with construction jobs being needed, with construction costs being relatively low, this was a good time to do these projects. So that's what the impetus was behind the bill itself. I'll get to the amendment a moment after folks have had a chance to see the amendment.
Does everyone have a copy of the A1 amendment?
Yeah.
Apparently they do, Representative Morrow.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, then, can I move the A1 amendment, and then we can talk about what the intent is behind the A1 amendment?
Okay. We have the A1 amendment before us. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary.
Mr. Chair, members, the A1 amendment was language that was added on the Senate side by Senator Murphy. I was going to invite Margaret Donahoe from the Transportation Alliance to discuss the components of the A1 amendment.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Margaret Donahoe with the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. The amendment that you have before you is language that we think is important to add to this bill. As you may recall, the bonds that were authorized under Chapter 152 were largely programmed for bridges. There was language in Chapter 152 that required MnDOT to look at structurally deficient bridges and make sure that those were being taken care of. And one piece of Chapter 152 also provided some additional bond authority specifically for interchanges. So the fact that most of the bonding was taken up by some of these major bridge projects didn't leave a lot of the bonding left for road projects, but there was some bonding provided specifically for interchanges, and it turned out to be a very successful program. And MnDOT solicited local governments for suggestions for interchange projects. There were more projects submitted than funding available, as usually happens. And so this is an effort to provide an additional $100 million in trunk highway bonds, with $30 million for road construction and $70 million specifically for interchanges. And you can see from the language that this funding would be split 50% in the Metro District and 50% for Greater Minnesota. It's been a good partnership between local governments and the department on these interchange projects. And with the new February forecast, we know that the revenue estimates for MVEST is up. The revenue estimate for license tab fees is up slightly. And so we believe that there is more capacity for some additional debt service that can be covered with this additional bond authorization.
There is a fiscal note showing that additional debt service. You all have it. Any questions? Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if somebody from MnDOT is here and can speak to what it does to your, first of all, if you support the bill and what it does to your cash flow, and if you have one of those nice little charts that shows your revenue and your debt service and whether it goes above and below the line and all those good things.
Welcome. We have a new person that will be before the committee quite a bit. You may introduce yourself and your title so the committee's aware of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Thomas Halverson. I'm the new CFO for MnDOT. So right now, Norm said I can take the training wheels off, so this is my original venture. So we are in the process of working a debt service policy, and it's pretty comprehensive. We'll be in front of the MMB, financial professionals, this week to discuss it in detail. But as Norm has briefed the Senate, the debt service levels that we're targeting, we're very capable of meeting those debt service targets and maintaining the appropriate service on the programs out there. As previously discussed with the chairman, and we feel that the debt service levels at peak, if we forecast out, and forecast there's a lot of ambiguity in them as far as interest rates and so forth, but we'd be looking at potentially peaking in the year of 2018 at 17% debt service level. That'd be under the trunk highway funding levels. Well, that's well within the policy guidelines that we're seeking to work with MMB at this point in time. So,
and Mr. Chair, it wasn't clear to me. Was this the 17% peak in 2018? Was that under current law or with this bill in mind,
Mr. Halverson?
And I didn't hear whether you supported, MnDOT supported the
I think MnDOT, Mr. Chairman and Representative, I think MnDOT is neutral at this point in time on this language.
And again,
Representative Hober,
the 2018, the 17% peak, does that assume that this becomes law or that's current law? And well, if not, how does this change it?
If we're pulling, Mr. Chairman and Representative, if we're pulling monies forward, which I think that if this bill does, that would be pulling what we had estimated in our debt service projection. So we would be including it implicitly, just paying for the debt service earlier in the cycle of years than we had anticipated.
And Representative Holbert. Mr. Chair, if you know, do you get above 17% earlier as a result? I mean, have you done the runs on this bill and? Can we see a copy of them as maybe
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have not done, to the best of my knowledge, specific forecasting as far as what, you know, running this forward, pulling everything forward as far as what the impacts would be. So.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The new debt service guidelines that the governor has established, there is one where he quantifies all debt, and that would include GO bonds and trunk highway bonds. And so that measure, you kind of don't make this decision in isolation of all debt. And I would hope that somewhere we're measuring how much of our debt do we want to do in transportation and how much in higher ed and how much in, conservation or how much in flood mitigation. I don't know how that's going to happen under that new debt service guideline, but somewhere somebody's got to make that decision.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I can't specifically answer to the overall MMB debt service levels that they're structuring. But the intent of this policy that we're proposing is to work within the guidelines and the framework of that overall debt service policy that MMB is proposing. So,
and Mr. Chair, I hear that, but do they then make the decision about how much debt we carry for transportation and how much for each of the other areas? That's what that's sort of a pretty big... policy issue.
Mr. Helverson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't know if I can answer that question. I don't want to make assumptions, but we would be within the confines of the overall debt service levels that the state is looking to manage within. So I can specifically address that when we get into those policy conversations with MMB, just to make sure that this is a comprehensive view of how MnDOT would participate in that structure.
That discussion hasn't been had, I think, in committees either, no.
Mr. Chairman, to the best of my knowledge, I agree.
Any further questions? Representative Morrow, you have any further? Do you have a
Well, Mr. Chairman, since it's Mr. Halverson's first time in the stand, if you want to continue the hazing, I can think up a whole list of questions. We can ask. Should we be merciful to him on his first trip, I guess.
I think he's pretty well prepared. I spent some time with him, Representative. Right. Any further questions? If not, Representative Morrow, you want to renew your motion that House File 2753, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Any discussion? Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Or,
aye.
Contrary? House File 2753, as amended, is passed and will be sent to the Finance Committee. Representative Hortman. That's the last one. And you're in good shape to get us out here by 6 o'clock, Representative.
I am, Mr. Chair. I know I'm your favorite member, and that's why I was put last in the most favored position on the agenda. Because nobody will ask any questions because they want to go.
Representative Hortman moves 2937B before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an amendment. It's the A1 amendment.
Be held over,
it right. Does the same thing to my bill that I did to Representative Holberg's bill. I just think when we ask for reports, we should expect to get them in an electronic format and not on paper. And I think all members of the committee should get it electronically rather than giving it to the chair and expecting the chair or his staff to have to forward it to everybody else. So I would offer the A1 amendment. I don't know if we need a vote on that.
Any discussion on the A1 amendment?
Mm-hmm. We've got to just get it passed out.
They don't have it yet. Oh. Representative Hortman, is this rather unusual? I'm not aware of any other report having this done yet.
Well, Mr. Chair, actually in Chapter 16 of, I believe it's Chapter 16 of Minnesota statutes, we require that when people submit a report to us that they do so electronically or they ask us if we want a paper copy. The only people who actually follow that law, I think, are the revisor's office. So that's why I keep putting it into bills, because I think they don't see it because it's in a different section of statute.
Any discussion on the amendment? Representative Hausman.
No, not on the amendment.
If not, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Contrary? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill just says once a year we'd like to know what MnDOT's doing with the money we've appropriated for passenger rail. I think members probably recall that we provided $26 million in, I believe, general obligation bonds in 2009, and we asked MnDOT to work on a passenger rail plan. And we had some testimony in Representative Hornstein's committee that their intention is to spend $16 million on the river route to Chicago and $10 million on NLX, but we haven't really given them any direction to say how they spend that $26 million. We really left it totally up to the commissioner's discretion, and I just think in our role as exercising oversight of taxpayer dollars, we need to find out once a year what they're up to with the money that we gave them for passenger rail.
Representative Hortman, was this policy then passed, what you're saying in the bill was passed in the policy committee?
No, Mr. Chair, it was sent to you, and it has a fiscal note of $3,000, but I find it hard to believe that it will cost $3,000 to forward to us something that better be used internally so that people know what we're spending our money on. I'm really asking for is whatever information they use to track how they're spending the money.
It seems the authors never agree with the fiscal note. Representative Zuer? Would you comment?
Mr. Chair and members, the $3,000 cost per year is staff time to actually prepare the report. So,
and Mr. Chair, I asked Mr. Burris to draft language, and we talked about this, that this is not a specific report that's created for this committee. I'm okay if they forward to us an email that, you know, the Dan Crome sends to his boss, Commissioner Sorrell, if he just forwards a copy to us that says, here's how we're spending the money. So I'll work on the fiscal note, but that's the bill.
Any further questions or discussion? Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Welty on the Holberg bill said it cautioned us that we shouldn't begin to compartmentalize and piecemeal this, and so I think it would be appropriate on this one as well. And what I think it shows us is that in the interim, Met Council and MnDOT do have a lot of work to do in a whole new direction of a number of modes where we look at governance and funding. Because all of that system should work in the same way as all of our other transportation does, and I've been regularly going to that passenger rail forum, and I think that might be the format on which that's going to happen. But I don't know who's going to provide the leadership, but you can see from these two bills that clearly there is some attempt to put this in a format, but it does seem to me that ultimately our agencies have to kind of take some responsibility to make sure that we don't create a lot of silos that are going to complicate things rather than clarify things.
Representative Hortman, do you have a comment or not?
No, originally the language we looked at it when we were considering the bonding request told them how to spend it, but we pulled back that language and we're just looking at a report now, so we're not telling them how to spend it, we're just telling them we'd like to be informed.
Any further questions? Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hortman, do you have anything in here that provides a report on the expected operation and maintenance costs of these lines, too?
Representative Hortman.
No, Mr. Chair. Representative Magnus, the purpose of this bill is we're giving a lot of discretion to the commissioner for how to spend $26 million in general obligation bonds. Typically, we're pretty prescriptive when we give the department or anybody money. We tell them how to spend it. And usually the legislative language, for example, our transportation appropriation bill outlines what they can spend on state road construction, what they can spend on debt service. This just says tell us what you're doing with the money. So I'm not going down the path that Representative Holberg is in terms of looking for another layer of analysis that they're not doing. I think if we went down that path, then there would be a fiscal note.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chair Leader. And to Representative Magnus, those numbers, if you want to find those, are in the statewide rail plan. And this is kind of building off of the statewide rail plan. The statewide rail plan was a comprehensive document that was put together that showed us what we have to do, not only with freight rail, but also passenger rail in the state of Minnesota. And in there, it did a pretty good analysis of passenger rail service and what the operation and maintenance of passenger rail service will be in the future. And so what we're asking for in here is just a report back on, as they start moving forward on the $26 million that's going to be put into passenger rail, tell us how you're spending it and on which lines. So then we know how that is a part of and fitting into that statewide rail plan that was just done.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hortman, you know, I attended one of the briefings that was in the local community on the statewide rail plan. And one of the questions I had asked at that point is there is a deconfliction study that's being done between passenger rail coal and what would happen if we actually had nuclear energy come in, which would reduce the amount of coal. I think that fell on deaf ears. So I'm just kind of considering, in terms of the $16 million that's designated for the one corridor and the 10 for the other, are those just kind of round numbers that we threw out there? And I appreciate you bringing some accountability into this process, but I'm curious as to, I guess I never saw a price tag that was assigned. This is the first time I've really heard any numbers that have come on the statewide rail plan issue. And I guess my concerns at that point would be, it's kind of like going to Target where everything is something 99. You know, they're just big numbers that just are kind of rounded off to the next whole number. I'm wondering if we are, as a legislature, going to be able to see any kind of numbers that are proposed for what these impacts are going. And I understand that that's what this kind of does, but it reports, but it doesn't give us any yes or no say-so in this whole process. We're basically just saying we're giving you this $26 million and spend it the way you want. In fact, spend $25,999,999 and call yourself Target. I don't get it. You know, I just don't get the accountability in this process.
You want to comment, Representative Hortman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We appropriated the $26 million in response to a request by the governor and by MnDOT in response to things that were happening at the federal level. And they had put some, you know, analysis together suggesting to them that $26 million was the amount we might be able to get some federal matching to move some projects forward. But you raised an issue of freight rail and how much are we spending and what are we getting and what do we need for coal or going into the future. This really gets at details in the passenger rail area. And in the freight rail area, it's kind of up to us to ask those questions when they come here.
Representative Severson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hortman. And specifically, when I did ask that question, it was as to a study, and obviously the nuclear is a hot issue still in Minnesota, and whether or not we can actually count on some new baseload energy requirements. But if we're looking in the out years for sustainable energy and reducing those amounts, obviously a reduction in coal time on the track would increase our availability for passenger rail, would cause less deconfliction. And that, I guess that was my other question, is how much has been studied in terms of deconfliction between passenger and freight? So those are all kind of open questions that I don't think the study necessarily got to. I would be interested in seeing what those numbers would be. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hortman, do you want to respond? That was an open.
No, I think that was a statement more than a question, wasn't it? I mean, there is an analysis in the statewide rail plan of the overlap between the freight needs and the passenger needs. And, for example, the river route between here and Chicago moves a lot of freight, much more freight than passengers. And so improvements in that corridor is really investment in freight more than it's investment in passenger rail. So I think that's why the $16 million is dedicated where it is. But really that's an issue for us to, we all need to do our homework and read the statewide rail plan that they spent a lot of time and money putting together. Because a lot of that analysis that Representative Severson is asking about is in that document. And I haven't read it either. I mean, it's 200 pages. I haven't read it. But we all should do that, and we should have a pretty in-depth discussion about it. More. We've already had one hearing on it, but we should have more going forward.
Any further questions? If not, House File 2937 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Transportation Bill. Any further questions or comments to come before the committee? not wait. Our next meeting is in March, is next Thursday at 4:30 in the same room. What? We have a lot of bills in the next, because we backed up, we've got a lot of bills in the next session, and I'd like to move the bills quickly so we don't have to go into night meetings. Meeting adjourned.